Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Okay, so let me just start by recounting the usual difficulties that we've had with black holes for over 30 years. As Bekenstein taught us in 72, if you take a black hole, that's the horizon. It should have an entropy given by the area divided by 4g, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. But then if you believe in the normal ideas of thermodynamics, it would suggest the black hole should have E to the S states. Where do you find these states? People look for them, didn't find them any simple way. Start saying black holes have no hair. If it actually has a unique metric, of course, if you take log of one, you'd get no entropy. And the question is, what does the area entropy actually mean? Somewhat more serious problem, but a related problem. Since you can't see the states here, this sort of looks just like empty space. And then when particle-antiparticle pairs are created near the horizon, you get your Hawking radiation. It doesn't have any information about what actually went in to make the black hole. Could that disappear in the center? And so if you can't see the states, you can't pick up any information in the radiation. And when the black hole is gone, you have information loss. Okay. So let's see what, after all the work that we have in string theory and whatever progress we had in the mid-90s, let's see if we can say any better about those questions. What I'm going to do in this talk is going to show you some calculations which are leading us towards perhaps a slightly different picture of the black hole. And I'll just show you the evidence and then you should draw your own conclusions. So this is the usual picture of a black hole. You have the horizon, you have the singularity in the center, and perhaps there's quantum fuzz of order Planck length in there. But this area is all nice, regular, solid space, just like the normal space in this room. But it seems that from some computation, one is being led to a picture where the whole interior of the black hole is actually somewhat non-trivial. So there perhaps would not be any special region that you would like to call a singularity. The different possible configurations here would actually have to manifest all the e to the s states that you're looking for. A typical region also have large quantum fluctuations. Just in special cases, we might get away without getting too many quantum fluctuations. But this region is just a general mess, and we don't completely understand this. But certainly wouldn't be empty space with a central dot the way a traditional picture is. So I'll just show you a few. Yes.
Are you advocating that this is how it would look to an infalling observer?
I'm nowhere close to being able to say what the guy would, an infalling observer would say. I have some conjectures on my last couple of transparencies, but most of my computations are static. Those are time-dependent questions. And for those, for most part, the answer is I don't know. Whatever I would guess about it, I'll tell you in the end.
Okay. But there's the related question, and that is what do you think this picture has to do with complementarity?
Complementarity for me is something which should come out of the thing. I don't want to impose it on string theory. It's completely possible if one understands this kind of stuff, this mess, in some good way, and in falling observer might see some version of complementarity. I don't know how to get it out of there yet. Okay, hopefully, maybe you could somehow get it out of there.
Do you expect the quantum fluctuations to be large inside the whole interior of, say, a solar mass black hole, as you've sort of drawn?
Yes, I would expect whatever mess is going on here is not in the vicinity of a Planck length of the center, but all over. So that's the real difference.
Okay.
So of course, that's sort of a logical extrapolation. I'm extrapolating from the little things we see here, and I just want to show you whatever we've been doing with string theory, and then we can come back to debating what the information transfer methods would be. So this is what I'm actually going to show you. Let's first take a simple system in string theory, the so-called two-charge extremal D1, D5 system. It's also a system which has a large number of states, a large ground state degeneracy. Some people might not want to call it a black hole. So let me not call it a black hole, though I'll argue to you in the end that whatever lessons we learn here also tell us something about black holes, and we should take those lessons seriously. But for this system, I can show you something rather explicit. The metric you would write for a D1, D5 system is just some D1 brains and D5 brains wrapped in a certain way, which I'll show you a few slides down. Obviously, far away from the brain goes to flat space, and that's what this means. As you go near to the brains, you put R equal to 0, you get some kind of a metric going down there. So locally, a D3 cross S3 cross D4. And we'll just call that the naive metric, the one you typically write down for a bound set of two kinds of brains. But in this case, we get lucky, and in fact, the classical metrics are good enough to analyze what really happens. And it turns out the naive metric is not really the metric you get for the D1, D5 system. Here I try to picture for you what I call the actual metrics, and don't actually reach R equal to 0. They all cap off before that, and you get smooth caps. And these caps could be various different kinds of caps, and in fact, all the different ground set of this system cap off, each ground set caps in a slightly different way. So you get a complete set of hair. And interestingly, if you actually try to draw a boundary where all the states typically differ from each other, some kind of a bound region like this, and also that they basically look the same, if you do the area of that and took A over 4G, it actually gives you the same, the right order for the entropy of these states. So here actually you get lucky, and the classical metrics have you can get all the states without having large quantum fluctuations, but that wouldn't hold more generally. More generally, you can see that fluctuations are going to be absolutely endemic to the whole thing. I'll then try to move on to something where we take these two charges, D1, D5, and add one unit of the momentum charge. For people who have been with the string theory story of black holes, if you have D1, D5, and a fair amount of momentum charge, you get the classical three-charge black hole, which Strominger and Wafer used to count the entropy and match it onto the classical Bekenstein entropy. And then actually we get a similar structure. The naive metric actually goes all the way to having a horizon at zero. And even though we can't actually make the generic state of the three-charge system, I'll show you one state here, and we've made a few other families in the last few weeks. In each case, the story is similar. Instead of reaching all the way to the horizon to R equal to zero, the guy caps off. Okay. In the end, I'll come back and try to show you what I think is the physical basis of what is happening here. If you actually want to change physical intuition over macroscopic distances like kilometers, you need something new to be going on. And what's happening is something we've been familiar with in the area of string theory and black holes for a while, a phenomena called fractionation. Essentially what it does is if you make a bound state of a large number of quanta, let's say n quanta, then the non-local effects you get, I'll argue, actually not limited to something fixed like Planck length or string length, but actually grow with n. It's not LP, but n times LP. And because that phenomena, the actual mess which is going to happen when you make a large black hole is not confined to a fixed length like L Planck around the singularity, but actually goes all the way. And the way the parameters work out, it takes you up to the horizon. So it's this fractionation. What it does is it creates very, very light and very floppy objects. We've actually used the same objects before in the counting of the entropy of black holes. And now what we are doing is we're using the same system which gave us the entropy and the radiation from black holes. And we are just asking a different question: what is the structure of these objects? Structure, how big do they become? And the conclusion we are seeming to get from this, extrapolating from the simple cases we see, is that these guys actually fluff, and they fluff up to have a size which in each case becomes comparable to the horizon area, which if you measure, it would actually give you the Bekenstein entropy. Okay, so let me start with this two-charge D1, D5 system where the story is easy to nail. And here I can show you things quite explicitly. So we'll take our type 2B string theory and we'll take the 10-dimensional space it lives in. We'll compactify five of these things. Four of them I have called T4. The fifth one is we'll use in a special way, so I just called it an extra S1. This coordinate is called Y. The T4 will hardly be used. The coordinates are Z1, D2, Z3, Z4. This is a non-compact 4+1 dimensional space, and you can put polar coordinates on it, and that will remain non-compact. You take N1, D1 brains, and you wrap it on the S1. You take N5, D5 brains, and you wrap it on the S1 cross T4, and their bound state is what's called the D1, D5 system. So if you do this, the naive metric you would write for this system, just a classical metric you might write, which has these charges, you define these functions which have the amount of D1 charge, the amount of D5 charge. You should place them all at the origin in 4+1 dimensions. Potentials fall off like R squared. We know these harmonic functions enter the matrix in supersymmetric configuration. The matrix are quite simple. In fact, the matrix would look like this is the part T and Y, transverse part, and this is the part in the T4, which doesn't do much. Well, we wouldn't actually look at the matrix for the most part. We just see them in the pictures, flat space far away. This region is locally ADS3 cross S3. I just say locally because the S1, which is part of the ADS3, is being compactified to a circle, and then it goes all the way to a singularity at r equal to 0. But note, I have called this the naive geometry, because we'll soon be seeing that this is actually not the metric produced by any state of the D1 and D5 planes. So let's see how you would actually see the true geometry, true states of the D1, D5 system. So here we know that by a set of dualities, you can take the D1, D5 system of 2B, and by just chasing your dualities around, you can come back to 2B, but you can convert it to what I call the FP system. F is just the fundamental string or the elementary string, I just call it F. And now that is wrapped N5 times around the same S1 we were talking about, and it carries N1 units of momentum P also along the same S1 direction. Well, again, for the FP system, you could write the metric one would typically write for two charges. The naive metric would again have these kinds of harmonic functions. These Q and Q prime are just the Q1 and Q5 plus the duality factors in it. And you write the metric, which again, in pictures, is flat space there and goes to something apparently singular sitting at r equal to 0. But here we can actually see that this couldn't have been the right metric for the FP system. And the actual geometry is a little different. And that happens in the following way. So again, if you take a lot of F strings, and suppose they were all not joined to each other, but just kept separately, so they are single loops like that. And suppose the momentum, which is carried by gravitons or the massless particles running around the circle, these guys carry momentum charge. If they were not bound to each other, that's what they look like. But we are looking at the bound states. The entropy we want to count is of the bound state of the F and the P. Of course, if you bind all the F together, it's clear what you get. You get a string which is wrapped N1 times and then closes on itself. But it's interesting, if you actually put the momentum on the string, if you bind the momentum to the string, then the momentum is just carried by traveling waves on the string. So of course, you can go to the covering space where you unwrap the string, and then the momentum is carried by traveling waves like this. It could be polarized in some direction. So I wrote the vector F of V, the transverse displacement, V is T minus Y. If you give the transverse displacement, you get the whole profile of the string. What is very important here is, and now we get to the basic crux of what string theory does, the elementary string actually has no longitudinal vibration. It's a basic fact of the elementary string. It doesn't have a longitudinal vibration. So in order to carry the momentum, it must necessarily bend away from the transverse axis. It just can't stay there. Once it bends like this, let's go back to the actual space, not the covering space, and see what the strands are doing. So the strands are all, this is the covering, the space is very small. This is wrapped many, many times. So you know, this strand shows up here. This piece of the strand shows up here, this strand shows up here, and this is what the string is doing. It's like a little piece of rubber band sort of wrapped all the way like this as carrying the momentum. And the classical limit when you take large charges, basically it becomes like a little ribbon going around, describing some kind of a path in the four-dimensional transverse space that we have. And that path basically has the information of F of V. You can see there are many, many configurations here which carry the same total momentum. And in fact, that's where the entropy of the two-charge system comes from. The entropy of F and P charges comes from the fact that you can carry the same momentum on a string by partitioning it in different ways among different harmonics. In fact, any F of V with the same total momentum is fine. It gives different paths here. But notice that in all these cases, the whole structure had now spread out in a transverse direction. And in fact, the more momentum you put on it, the more the guy spreads out. And in fact, the amount of the spreading, the transverse size, is not fixed to any fixed length like Planck length or string length. It just grows with the number of charges. So we're going to see, we can actually construct the metric now. If we just had one strand for a string, we know how to construct the metric. These people made the metric for a single strand. But of course, it's also known that if you had many strands of a string, as long as the wave is moving in the same direction, you could simply superpose the harmonic functions occurring in the metric, and you will get the metric of many strands. So the only extra thing we had to do here was that if we take all these strands, we superpose the contribution of each of them. And of course, here we had taken a classical limit, so the sums of a strand sort of just go to integrals. And here is the metric. The metric, again, has harmonic functions occurring in it. But you can see these functions are all actually connected. They're not arbitrary functions. They all come from this profile F of V that we had. So this X minus F of V keeps coming here, but this H inverse actually has a 1. This guy has the F dot square. This guy has the Fi dot. If you put any arbitrary harmonic functions, you would get some solution here, but a general solution will simply correspond to independent Fs and Ps kept in various places. It's very important we are trying to nail down the bound state of the F and P. So we have one continuous function F, and all these things linked together in this way will give a certain metric, and those are all the possible metrics of the FP system. You could dualize this back now all the...
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify. if it was really just a fundamental string wrapped on a circle, then F would describe fluctuations in 8 transverse directions.
Yes, so I should say I simplified. You could also, so the 4 directions are in the non-compact, and 4 are in the T4.
But you're somehow suppressing the T4.
Okay, but just for convenience. In principle, they are all 8 are there, absolutely. If you do it in the T4, it's equally fine. It's just that you have to then be careful to add the images, because if it's in a T4, then you get the images across all the walls. It's just technically a mess to write down, but it doesn't change anything. In fact, after we did this paper, in the paper of Lewin, Malthus, and Maus, they did the other half. They just wrote down the thing. There they actually coarse-grained in a way which I'm not completely comfortable with, but in principle, nothing new happens.
But when they check out. States, you don't...
No, you should count those also, absolutely.
You should count.
Half the entropy is there.
But you don't worry about it.
I'm not worried about it. I'm not going to put a factor of 2 in the entropy, so I'm not worried about it. Yeah.
Okay. And the other question was, maybe you're going to come to this, but when you... The fundamental string can't carry longitudinal momentum, so it's clear that it has to fluctuate.
Yes.
But in a D1, D5 system, I could imagine putting all the 5 brains here and all the 1 brains along it. And so it's not clear why the naive metric...
Yes, I'll try to tell you that. Absolutely, yeah. No, I'm glad you asked that. It's not in the transpace. They'll use the board and show that to you. It's very interesting because looking directly at the D1, D5, you wouldn't know that the guy blows. But here, if you notice, the DLTs are all in the compact direction, the T4 and the S1. And the non-compact size is exactly as it is. So if the FP has been gyrating around to a macroscopic size like this, and that you can't help because that was a rigorous derivation, you dualize back, the same size falls back to the D1, D5. And so when you dualize this back to D1, D5, I'll tell you why it blew in the D1, D5 language. But first, let me just show you the metrics. So again, I'm sure you don't want to actually see the functions, but you get your dilaton, your two-form field, your HA. And so they all show up in the metric. As you know, when you do DLT, some you get various powers of the fields in different places. And so these metrics are all the possible, give you, or they're parameterized by one function f of v, which is coming in all these functions. And they're all solutions of D1, D5 system. They're all supersymmetric quarter BPS solutions. And they're the actual states of the D1, D5. So let's go back to your question. Why did the D1, D5 system want to blow up? Okay. It really actually has, if you look at, for example, the D1s as instantons resolved in the D5. Okay, instantons in the D5. A little bit of this will be more clear after to the CFT part, but let me give a short answer now and come back to details later. There are lots of fermion zero modes which actually also exist in the system. Okay. When you apply those fermion zero modes, they carry spins, and the spins have spin half comma half under the SU2 cross SU2 in the non-compact directions. The number of these fermion zero modes is large. And ultimately, this is what actually manages to make it blow up. Now, you might say, why does spin become the same as size? But it's interesting why spin becomes the same as size. I'll give you something very, okay, just an analogy. This is not exact. Can I put on some lights here? Okay. Is this okay to use here? Yeah. And if you just take 2 D0 brains, let's keep them next to each other. And you can put lots of open strings between them. And as you know, the open string carries a polarization. Let's call this direction x1. So let me put lots of open strings all polarized in direction x1. So it's an SU2 story. So as an SU2 guy, if the open strings go from one brain to the other, they are, let's say, in the sigma 1. So the x1 matrix is sigma 1. The brains are still in the same place. I just put lots of open strings going from one to the other, and they're all polarized this way. But if I do an SU2 gauge transformation, I can take the sigma 1 and I can equally well make it a sigma 3. And now I have a large number of sigma 3 in x1. But if you look at this, if you had a sigma 3, you would know immediately you're talking of 2 D0 brains which are actually split apart in the direction x1. So something is rather tricky that what. So here you just had a lot of open string which all had spin, although the spin was pointing that way. Look at it in a slightly different way. It's just a gauge transformation. You see size. Okay. A little bit of this story you'll see when I do the CFT map for this. You see it's actually in the D1, D5 language, every component of the effective string carries a spin half comma half. And you literally see how that spin is actually giving rise to this size. Okay. It's a quantum effect, but the point of the number of spins is order n1, n5. It blows macroscopically. So that's why the classical thing wouldn't have shown it. We are normally, when we think of deep brains, we are thinking of 1 or 2. But of course, the black hole problem is when you have stringy objects, but a large number. So any quantum effect can magnify. And in the FP, of course, you can see it magnifying. And the DLTs are exact, so it just comes down the transverse direction. So we had these metrics, and at first one might wonder if at these places where x is equal to f of v, this is the place where the string was running in the FP description, it looks like these guys might be singular. In fact, at first we thought they were, but nothing seemed to be actually able to enter that singularity. Every time we threw something at it, it would just scatter back. So after we played those games, we were quite puzzled. But at some point later, it was pointed out in a paper of Lunin, Maldacena, and Maus that really when you go near here, just put the lights off again. You might think there's a singularity at this location, x equal to f of v, but it turns out that this is not really a singularity. It's actually only a coordinate singularity. In fact, it's exactly the same coordinate singularity as you get at the center of a Kaluza-Klein monopole. Your Gross-Perry monopole, if you actually go down there, what you find is the singular curve we had was one simply closed connected S1 in the non-compact directions. This is the shadow of the FP system of the covering space, gives a simple closed curve. If you go back to the D1, D5 language and you go look near the closed curve, take a cross section here, in these directions, it is exactly a KK monopole. So whatever was a singularity was only a coordinate singularity, and that's why we couldn't throw anything into that singularity. There was nothing there. So it's a KK monopole tube. So you take a KK monopole cross S1, and in fact, if you look into the paper of Gross and Perry at some later point in the paper, you'd notice it, them saying that a monopole, anti-monopole can just be left there, and they don't actually attract or repel because the scalar effect of the scalar actually cancels the effect of the gravity. And in fact, you can see one part of you think of as a monopole, one part of an anti-monopole. The whole tube can be left in any shape you like, and you have all these configurations, which are basically all have the same mass charge. They're all VPS, and they're all the solutions of the D1, D5 system. So that's the local structure. There's no net KK monopole charge, because if you think of this side as monopole, this side is going like an anti-monopole. At this point, you realize that this is actually a little after we did this. The supertube people also made the metric for a supertube, and they also checked in their paper that if they dualized it to D1, D5, it actually became our metric. So you could also, if you took a supertube of F and D0, it blows up into a D2. If you dualize it all the way back and ask, instead of F and D0, if you start with D1 and D5, instead of D2, the supertube actually blows into a KK monopole tube. So basically what one is seeing is that solutions do blow, and you can get huge, large families of solutions, and that's where all the degrees of freedom really are. So once you had the solution, it was sort of curious to see what is the scale at which the generic ones start differing from each other. So suppose you take this guy and you just coarse grain it by keeping that part of the thing which is common to all the solutions where they don't differ much, and chopping off the part where they start differing from each other. In some rough intuitive way, you might think that's coarse grinning, because coarse grinning means you keep the degrees of freedom common to all microstates and discard the ones that differentiate between them. Anyway, that's just a word, but when you draw this, if you take the area of this hole you open, individually the metrics had no horizon and no singularity. If you look at those metrics, they were completely smoothly capped. But now if you actually go and look at the area of what you open up and you compute A over 4G, it actually agrees towards within this factor of order unity, which you can't fix because you don't know exactly where to cut. It agrees with the entropy of the system. So you actually recover the idea of area entropy from a coarse graining over the microstates. The individual microstates actually had no horizon, and so you should not associate an entropy with them, which is how it should be. If the individual microstates had a horizon, if I have time, I'll come and show you that argument also later. If individual microstates had a horizon, you would be tempted to go and say those microstates should have further entropy because they have a horizon, and we try to make a link between horizons and entropy. But anyway, as it turns out, individual microstates don't have any horizons, and if you coarse grain over them, a surface pops up, and that seems to give the idea of the Bekeston entropy. To make sure this is not a complete fluke, we also tried doing this for states with angular momentum. So you could demand, you look at a subset of states which have a given angular momentum J. That's easy to make. If you go back to the language where you have the FP system, you could give the string an angular momentum, which means most of its energy actually goes in trying to maintain a helical profile, and the rest of the energy goes into small vibrations around that profile. And the macroscopic entropy you can work out for the system, and that's easy. And now if you look at the metrics you get, they differ from each other only in a small donut-shaped region around the projection of the helix. They are basically the same everywhere except in this donut. And if you draw this surface where they differ from each other and you measure the area and do area upon 4G, you get the, up to the twiddle which you can't fix, you get the entropy again.
that's not an area of a torus region?
Yeah, it's the area of a donut shape. So as you know, as gravity people have been finding out in the last few years, if your dimension is higher than 3 plus 1, the horizon doesn't have to be spherical. It could well be donut shaped. And this is 4 plus 1, and it's perfect.
This is not a horizon. This is just a cutoff sort of.
Yeah. But we are finally going to claim that all horizons look like this, that for everything, even a three-charge system, the first ball blows and the interior looks like this, and you're going to cut it off exactly like this. So that's what we'll try to claim for generic stuff.
So you claim that you actually talk about the entropy
ring? We are claiming what?
So it's a black ring, you actually calculate the entropy
form? No, it's not a black ring.
No, there's no horizon,
no. No, but the stretched horizon.
Yeah, if you take the stretched horizon as a horizon, it looks like a black donut, yeah. Which charges is an extremal black ring. Yeah. Okay, so let's play a little bit more with the states we have and try to connect them to the CFP so that we understand something about all this hair which the D1, D5 system seems to give us. So here's I'll just pull from the CFP only those pieces that we really need. So here's again, we have this type 2B theory on M9, 1. We've compactified DS1 and the T4. And this M4 come up in the non-compact directions. The angular directions is an S3. So that has a symmetric group SO4, which you can write as SU2 cross SU2. The way the brains have been dealt with, here is the T4, here's the S1. Suppose I draw the compact directions like this. The N5, D5 brains are wrapped on the T4 cross S1. The N1, D1 brains are wrapped on the S1. And then if you just use the kind of rough hand-weaving models we were all using for this way back in 96, if you bind the D1 and D5 brains together, you get an effective string which has a winding number, which is not N1 or N5, but N1 times N5, and I'll just call that capital N. You can make all this more rigorous and make an orbifold CFT, which actually describes the some deformation of the orbifold CFT is supposed to be the true description of the D1, D5 bound state. We don't actually need much details of the orbifold CFT, but I'll just pull out from that the one part which you actually need in addition to whatever picture one was using naively in the old days. And that is the following. Of course, if you have this effective string whose winding number is N1, N5, there are many states here. You could close each strand individually into a circle, or you could join some strands into double strands, or you could join the whole thing up into one strand. There are many possible states. But the one extra thing we will need, and that's very important, is that each of these components of the effective string actually has a spin which is a half comma half under this SU2 cross SU2. Okay. I'll show you in a second how it comes if you really wanted to see. We've actually done quite a lot of work in developing how to do correlation function for this orbifold CFT, and I wouldn't be talking about any of that part, but I'll just extract this business about the spin because we are going to need that. So of course it's not surprising that a string has a spin. If you take an ordinary elementary string or a D string, it's T dual or related by T and S dual T to a graviton, and a graviton has spin too. So even if you have a string sitting somewhere, it has spin. These, of course, are part of the effective string, and so that would have had spin too, but this is spin only half comma half in two SU2s, and the spin somehow went down, roughly speaking, because it's coming from a bound set of two things. So anyway, we have all these different ways of cutting up the effective string, and if I draw any such picture, this is one of the possible ground states which I could make for this D1, D5 system. We know there are a lot of ground states for the D1, D5 system. You can cut up the effective string into any way, as long as the total winding number is n, and each guy has a spin, half comma half. You count all of these, you get all the states, the D1, D5 CFT. So where does the spin come from? In case anybody is interested, you actually, the D1, D5 system is actually in the Raymond sector, because if you take any D1 brains or D5 brains and wrap them on a circle, the periodicity of the fermions on the brain is induced from the periodicity of the fermions in the bulk, and the fermions in the bulk are periodic because otherwise the vacuum energy would be non-zero and you wouldn't have flat space as a solution. So we know that this, when you wrap D brains on a circle, the CFT ends up in the Raymond sector. If it's in the Raymond sector and you actually want to make the CFT, you actually have to put spin fields to get the state in the Raymond sector. If you take your the currents and you bosonize them, you make your spin fields, you find that you end up getting the spin half comma half. You can also prove this by spectral flow. You take the NS vacuum, which has no spin, you spectral flow to the R vacuum, it just picks up a spin half. Okay, so if you just do that, this is actually, we had already got this duality which had taken us from the FP system all the way to the D1, D5 system. You can do that and you can chase down what happens to different states of the D1, D5 system. So in the FP, the configuration was given by some profile f of v of the string which was vibrating. Now that was classical. At a quantum level, clearly you would like to break it up into the different harmonics, and you have a certain number of excitations of each harmonic. So the nth harmonic, which is polarized in the direction, there are four transverse directions, I equal to 1, 2, 3, 4. You could, this tells you which way you're vibrating. This tells you which harmonic you are in. You apply this creation operators on the string standing straight, and you add up all these numbers to the total amount of momentum. Those are all the states of the vibrating string. If you take it over to the D1, D5 system, if all the string rings are separate, if you take all the pieces of the effector string and you close them into separate circles and put them in the NS sector, you actually get the NS vacuum. If you want to create any given Raman ground state, you have to apply twist operator sigma n, also spectral flow to the Raman sector. So again, the stuff about the CFT I'm not really showing you here. I'll just show you the final pictures. You take n of them and you twist them together. You make something which is joined n times. And then here's the correspondence. You take the NS vacuum and you act on it with these operators. If you had the nth harmonic, it corresponds to a twist operator which joins you into a circle which has n twists. And if you were in some particular vector component of this SO4, you can write it SO4 as an SU2 cross SU2. And you put that particular polarization to these spins of the spin field. And then you get all these possible configurations. You count them and you get the right number. This was the entropy of FP. These are all the possible configurations of D1, D5. So in fact, this is useful because now if you take any given state of the D1, D5 CFT, it's given by telling you what you're doing to the effector string. The effector string has wiring number N1, N5. You could break it up into joint all to one loop or to different loops. This picture just shows you what you've done to it. You can give different spins to the different pieces. And then for this state, if you ask me what is the metric, I'll just convert it to its harmonics. If I know the harmonics, I can make the profile. If I make the profile, I know the metric. I dualize back another metric for D1, D5. So for every state, actually, I know the metric.
So just from this picture that you've drawn with these multiple winding strings, that's consistent with the whole system being at the origin of the non-compact.
Yeah.
You don't see anything.
But it's these guys which do the story. That's why I said the spins are very important. Those arrows are going to do it. That's where the story is, yeah. So if you ignore those arrows, you wouldn't have gotten this one. Because you can see, well, if you want to see from this itself, it's these arrows which are actually, this SU2 cross SU2 spin is what became this polarization. So if I spin this guy in the XY plane, okay, then this polarization, let's say, is in the X1 plus IX2, X1 minus IX2. That spin shows up here, and it's directly the angular momentum. See, the DLT is all in the compact direction. So if you, for example, look at things with net angular momentum, and you don't have to, but suppose you look at things with net angular momentum, that has to go to the other side too. And so if the FP system was swinging with a large angular momentum, the D1, D5 also has to have it. If you put it at a point, you couldn't get it. In any case, the metric is not that. So what would you like to do with this? You'd like to play some dynamical experiments to see that all the different states you've got, can you actually trust them? I mean, they just look like different states, but if you play dynamical experiments, are they all just like within a quantum fuzz of each other so you can't see them? Or can you actually distinguish all this here by dynamical experiments? You throw some quantum in, you want to check back reactions, you want to send something and get it out. So you want to check all that thoroughly and be sure that you are dealing with real things and not just some figment of the imagination. So what kind of dynamical experiments would you like to perform? So you can take a special subfamily of geometries, and this is something, a family which dates back, they are very symmetrical, so discovered in special as family of solution by Swathi-Chiom, also used by Balasubramaniam, Ross et al., and also in paper by Maldacena Maus. If you trace back to this particular story, where do they come from? You take the F fundamental string, and suppose you swing it in a uniform helix. So you can give a helix a single turn, it can give it many turns. Now it's a very symmetrical solution. In principle, the string could have done anything it wanted. If you swing it in a uniform helix and give it n turns in the covering space, the system actually has a particular actual symmetry because you went in just one plane and has a lot of symmetry. Metrics are particularly nice. And if you go back to the D1, D5 system and see what you've done is all these component strings, the number of times you wrap the string, they all have the same size. They all, let's say, wrapped n times before closing, and all the little spins this time are actually all aligned. So just a particularly simple family you want to take. The number of these pieces, M, is total winding number upon whatever winding each one of them individually takes. So what game would you like to play with this? So here's an experiment you might think of. And this dates back to the story we were all doing with black holes in 96. If you take this D1, D5 string and you have a graviton coming by, it gets absorbed on the string. If it gets absorbed on the string, what does it do? It gets converted to vibrations. One moves up and one moves down because momentum is conserved. So one goes up, one goes down. And the gravity picture, what was going on in the same time in 96, this is what we were all computing. You have flat space, then you have this metric as a throat, and this guy is coming from outside, and if it got absorbed on the string, it meant it actually went into the throat. And again, if you remember the story, what happened was the probability of this absorption was equal to the probability of this being swallowed, and so that's what one said one had learned something about black holes. But in fact, now you can see there's an additional step to the story, because if these guys go around the string, after some time they're going to come around and they're going to bang into each other, and then they can come off the string. So after some time they're going to come off. If this throat just kept going on and on, of course the guy wouldn't come back. Have some kind of a contradiction. Of course, if the throat was capped the way we have now seen, then the guy is going to come back from there, and we can ask if these two times agree. Okay, of course, later on I'm going to take you all the back rake and so on to make sure that as the guy is going down, the distortion was small, you can trust it. That's a different part of the story. I may not get time to go into it in detail. I'll just give you the answers for how the story works out. The CFT part of the computation is actually very simple. We said each of these pieces is wrapped n times. That's for the number of pieces was total winding number upon little n. And this the you do the absorption game, and that's the old way of computing the absorption probability. That's not a new story. But you take the string and you open it up. I just open it up here. This guy got absorbed here. These vibrations are going to move along the string at the speed of light. What is the length of the string? 2 pi r. R is the length of my wrapping circle S1. The total winding number was N1, N5, but then there are M pieces, so I divide it by M. That's the length of the string. The time to travel is that length, it's speed of light, so speed is 1, but then half, because this guy goes here and this guy goes here and they meet again here. So times a half, and so this is the time you get when they can collide and the guy can actually come off. Of course, once the guys collide, there's some probability it will be emitted. Of course, the remaining probability will just continue once again around, and they can miss and they may not come out. Okay, what will you have to do on the supergravity side? So the supergravity side, so we take a scalar wave equation, box phi equal to 0, this absorption with where you had exactly one pair going up, one member of the pair going up, one member going down, describes scalars in the dual theory. If you had other guys with higher spin, then you would have additional fermions going up and down. The scalars has just some equation, box phi equal to 0, and the particularly nice metrics we have taken because they have the actual symmetry. In fact, the wave equation even separates. I first saw this in a paper of Sothage and Larson, it may date even before that. So you can write out the wave equation. Okay, and then you can try to solve the wave equation by the usual techniques of matching solutions and solving it here. And this is how the story comes up. You send a particle coming in from infinity. We are at low energies. All this game is done at low energies. So there's some probability P it goes in, and some probability 1 minus P it doesn't go in. And P is small because at low energies, if you remember, the cross sections are much less than 1. Here's the answer for the cross section. Taken from the old days, the calculation. But now here's the new part. You can compute how long it takes to go and come back. So you take the wave packet and you follow the peak of the wave packet and do the whole story. If you do it carefully, you find some time, delta t. That's the time you get. And when it comes out near the mouth, you might think it just falls out. But quantum mechanics in 1D is completely reversible. So in fact, the probability was small for it to go in. It's small for it to come out. So chance of 1 minus speed goes back in. Chance speed comes out. And then it tries again. So that's the story. So now we have the same kind of picture on the CFT side and a similar picture on the gravity side. So I just put them together on this sheet to show you how they run. So the particle comes in, some probability P supergravity for it to be absorbed, 1 minus P for it to leave. So the calculation, the old days using the dB action, they tell us that we have the same probability for being absorbed in the CFT. Then we have some time in supergravity for going and bouncing and coming back to the front. We get exactly the same time from the CFT. So you know, even that factor of 2 we had, yeah.
But to get the factor 2, you have to know exactly where you're stopping.
No, it's very interesting that you don't. Okay, yeah, I'll tell you, yeah.
If I cut it off a little bit different, okay. The time doesn't change.
No, it doesn't change. Because the time we are going to get from this, if you see from the old transparency, it is proportional to N1 and 5. Okay. So you're looking at a time which is N1 and 5 or a half N1 and 5. Those are the scales we are looking at. This difference is only is very submitting. It's order 1 compared to N1 and 5. So this is the uncertainty here is of the order of the radius of the ADS, which is N1 and 5 to the 1/4. Okay. So that's not the way it comes. In fact, what we did was even more accurate. You can sit back here at infinity, which you send particles from infinity, and you let them come all the way back out to infinity, even negotiating this messy region. Okay. And we actually measured the peaks here. And then it was very clean. We didn't even have to say where they end. But if you wanted to end them here, it makes no difference. In fact, you can take a limit of this where the flat space is cut off. As you know, this region is ADS. You can cut this. You can take a limit where you're dealing just an asymptotically ADS space. Then you're sending something in. It's coming out to the boundary of ADS. And then the times are measured in units of the ADS time. And you can just make it a pure ADS CFT game and throw out the flat space completely. Yeah.
I'm going to say that what you're doing here. I mean, what I would normally say when I see these pictures is you have two different kinds of calculation with different ranges of validity.
Absolutely.
You have sort of a D-brain calculation on
the
gravitational translation on the left, and you have a parameter G string that you vary, which controls which is the relevant one to use.
Yes.
And some things like this give the same answer because they're protected by non-normalization. Is that what you're saying, or are you saying this more?
I'm not saying anything more than that. Yeah. So this is exactly what one was saying about all things like near extremal entropy, gray body factors, Hawking radiation. It's the same story. Somehow what's working at the back of this is the fact that it's not just the change in coupling between the orbifold point and the supergravity point is order one, but in processes like this, somehow the actual net effect is a 1 over n1 and 5. It's 1 over n. So it's the g over n which comes in and not g. And somehow that's why one is getting the protection. If you look at the deformation, in this case is by a twist operator sigma 2. The stress of a sigma 2 is sigma 2 ij. You can twist together any two copies. It actually has an automatic normalization 1 over n, because you sum over all the copies, you normalize it to 1. There's a 1 over n behind it. So chance for any two strands to be twisted is actually down by 1 over n. We haven't actually worked out what to do with these twists in general, but somewhere buried in there, I think, is going to be a effect where the 1 over n suppression basically buys you an easy transition between the supergravity point and the orbifold point. But let me not press that. I don't know any more than this, because this is the same old story we have always played. But that is certainly one game we actually very much would like to go and do now. We already have worked out, I'm not showing that in this talk, how to compute correlation functions, twist operators in the orbifold theory. So we had a set of papers doing that. And the actual normalization of that coefficient which distorts the CFT to the gravity has now also been worked out in a paper of Gava and Narayan using the PP wave study for ADS3. So we know exactly what operator it is, we know how to compute correlators, we can compute any deformation that is wanted. We just haven't gone and done that. Okay. But absolutely, we are pulling the same trick of comparing two different points, which was pulled in all the old black hole story. Here, so these times match, and of course this guy just comes in, returns back for another try, and here also they miss and they go back for another try, and the story is consistent with all exact numbers, and so the new result here is this, and these times are exactly fine down to the last factor of 2. I just want to note that these times actually are much bigger than the time scale, which is just the radius of the ADS. So a lot of ADS CFT calculations, just they keep picking up the same scale of ADS, which is actually N1, N5 to the 1/4. These times are more like, for a generic state, N1, N5 to the half. This is very, very Lorentzian physics. It's in the Lorentzian section that you actually get these long things and they cap off, and you can't Euclidize these geometries. You're in the Raymond sector. There are a lot of ground state of the system in the Raymond sector. Each of them has a different metric. Each of them has a different behavior in the CFT. Each of them has a correspondingly different behavior in the gravity. So each hair is probed. Any question? OK, so if that's what we know about the 2-charge, let me now try to say what would one possibly like to do about 3-charge. Before I go to that, I want to say something about how seriously we should take the 2-charge system. One often says this is not a black hole because it doesn't have a classical size horizon. But I want you to notice something about this. Again, this is the same picture for 2-charge before, just the D1, D5 here. Let's put the 2-charge the same order of the order of n. And this was what we had drawn as the so-called horizon here. If you look at the radius of that horizon, in terms of the 5D Planck length, it's actually not small. It's n to the 1/3 times the Planck length. Certainly not Planck length, much bigger than Planck length. In the D1, D5 system, dilatron is also bounded. Dilatron is 1, if you like, is a constant all the way to the end. So it's also n to the 1/3 times the string length. The scale of this horizon is bigger than Planck length, bigger than string length, nowhere near any of them, macroscopic number times that. It is certainly not small. Why then would we like to say that this horizon, in some sense, is small? It turns out that this metric has another scale in it. As you know, there's a time place where this ADS region turns over to flat space that has these functions. And if you see what radius comes in there, root q, q could be either of these, that goes like n to the half. Okay. So of course, for a classical guy, this goes with charge radius, it comes from the charge part of the metric. A classical guy is trying to take the limit of large n to make a big object. If he tries to keep this radius classically to be order 1, that poor guy gets squeezed off to zero. So that's why nobody will ever write you a classical metric which came from flat space with a sphere of order one and then showed you a little horizon in the tip. But personally, I would think it's not really the fault of this guy here, because the whole horizon physics is all here. In fact, you can even lop off the flat space, make it asymptotically ADS, and pick up all the same physics. And this physics seems to be very unrelated to what's happening here. For example, you can play your games here. Whether you leak out into flat space or not is a little different. So if you sympathize with that, I would say that whatever you're learning about the horizon from here, the fact there's a larger object there is not really relevant. What is relevant is that the object you're looking at here is much larger than either Planck length or string length or any other finite length you would have locally in the system. So what are we learning from here does tell me something about more general systems too, I would tend to think. We have a system which has swelled up because of these stringy effects, not to size L Planck or L string, but to n times L Planck or L string, number that grows with the quanta and grows all the way to its own horizon size.
But still, in some sense, it is important that you're near the extremal limit.
Extremal is very important. I've stuck to extremal all through with this. Non-extremal, I'll say something about it later, but absolutely, this is all extremal. If you're saying that we have, from this, learned nothing about non-extremal, that is absolutely true. That will come later. Yeah. So what we'd like to say about, if you want to move to three charge, D1, D5, and P, well, the knife geometry, again, has a similar structure, flat space here, then there's this long throat. At R equal to 0, that's where, in these coordinates, we say there's a horizon. And you can fall through that in finite proper time, presumably if you're a falling guy. Then there's a whole interior region to the black hole, inside which there must be some kind of a singularity. And so that's the whole structure. But now, based on what we've seen for two charge, one might start wondering if actually that's not the truth, and you never really reach R equal to 0 like you didn't do there, and perhaps you actually cap off. Now, if that were true, in this case, at least for one thing, you get lucky. If you were to actually then cut this here and measure the area and ask if it gives the entropy, this time that's going to work out for sure, because in the D1, D5P, the radius of the throat actually saturates, not actually going down as you go in. Because the radius saturates, it doesn't matter whether you cut here or here or here, it's actually going to give the same area. So A over 4G this time will give the entropy exactly. So that's not going to be the problem. The real question which we really want to tackle is, do these guys cap, or do you smoothly, through R equal to 0, go on to a whole new interior region, which is the inside, which has its own singularity, blah, blah, blah. And so let's see what we can do about it. We couldn't make the generic three-charge solution, but we have made several subfamilies now, and one of those I'm going to show you here. And for each of them, the story sort of works out the same way, so this is as good an illustration as any. What we'll do is we'll take the D1, D5 system and try to add to it one unit of P, just to see qualitatively what happens, and see if that geometry stays of the kind it is, and has a nice cap, and so on. So we start with a particular D1, D5 geometry to which we'll add the one unit of P. Is the simplest metric you could think, where in the FP language, you had a uniform helix with just one turn. And as I said, that's the metric which was dealt with before by several people. So we'll take with that D1, D5 system and look for a supergravity perturbation that actually carries one unit of momentum, which is e to the IPY, that's the S1 direction where you want to put the momentum. It's going to be VPS, so you know the time dependence you're looking for, omega equal to P. You're looking for a wave function like this, but most important, you'd like this wave function to be completely regular everywhere. And that's not trivial, because if you have a nice smooth region like this, if you try to make a decay here, it's going to blow to a singular point there. If you try to make it regular here, it's going to blow on this side. And if you actually had a solution which, for example, if you forcibly decayed it here, if you try to blow to a point here, you could take that as evidence that if you try to add the third charge, it starts creating an incipient horizon which will grow bigger. Incipient singularity which would go bigger, and then you would say, okay, the story is different for three charge. On the other hand, if you get this completely smooth solution, then you would say at least one charge of the three, one solution of the three charge family is nicely capped, doesn't go to R equal to zero, so you have reason to believe that maybe they are all capped. How do you construct this solution? So we solve for it by a matching technique. The length of the throat is a parameter. You can make it long, and then the two sides sort of separate off. This side is actually for this metric, with a coordinate change is just ADS3 cross S3, where in fact, because it's ADS3 cross S3, you know exactly what state also you're dealing with. This state is the Poincaré patch. You solve the solution here, you solve it there, you glue it together. You don't really want to see the details. I just want to mention here that you make a state which has L0 minus L0 bar equal to 1. That's the one unit of momentum. And you know exactly which state it is for which you're actually making the metric. But I'll just flash to you what kind of calculations one does. One goes at various orders in this length, 1 over the length of the throat. We did 4 orders, 0, 1, 2, and 3. I'll only show you 0 because by the time you get to the third, these are enormous computations running the whole night in the computer. But the check works out absolutely beautifully. So at the leading order, these are your field equations. The simplest thing you could take has a two-form and a scalar both mixed in. That's the simplest chiral primary ground state perturbation you could take. In the inner region, you get some solution for the scalar and all the two-form fields. You obviously don't want to see the details of that. And this is all at the zeroth order. And the outer region, you make a solution, and also has the scalar and all the fields. And then in the intermediate region, you see that all these numbers basically completely match up. Now, this is what we call order zero. By the time you go to order four, you have so many harmonic, spherical harmonics mixed in there that you're comparing about 10,000 different rational functions on the inside and the outside, and only a computer could compare them. The rational functions all have long numerator and denominator, and they're total about 10,000 of them. They match up exactly on both sides. And if you make any mistake, of course, you find that the guy which is smooth here blows up there, what is smooth there blows up here. But when you do it all exactly right, it exactly matches. For the scalar, we've actually managed to sum the series to closed form. For the two form, we haven't yet summed it to closed form, but we are trying to do that. And I think we also know why we couldn't sum it before. So soon we'll be able to sum this. We also made a few, we are in the process of making a couple of other families of subfamilies of solutions. They're not generic three charge states, but all the ones we find are completely smooth and they have caps. And so they seem to be following the same story thus far as the two charge guys. Now, if all this is to be true, there must be some physics underlying this, because it's particular for largest black holes. You would like to know how could things become, our intuition change over macroscopic scales. And I had said before that the story has to do with this idea of fractionation. So let me just take you a little bit through that story in the small time that I have. So it's just a basic idea how fractionation popped up in all the language of black holes and string theory in around 96. This thing is very simple, so I'm sure it was in millions of other places too. If we just take a single string of length L and wrap it in a circle, if you had to vibrate that string, adding no other net charge, no momentum in particular, the minimum threshold of excitation for the vibration going up is 2 pi by L, for the vibration going down, another 2 pi by L. So that's your threshold, delta E minimum is 4 pi over L. If I give you n different strings and they were all separate circles, you don't do any better because you can actually excite any one of them, and delta E minimum is still 4 pi over L. But if you made a bound state, and that's the kind of thing we actually after in black holes, if you make a bound state, then you have a string of total length LT, which is N times L. And then the minimum threshold is 2 pi over LT plus 2 pi over LT is 4 pi over NL. So you find an N at the bottom, and the threshold becomes really much smaller. And this, in fact, was used in the three-charge system, where you have this effective string which wraps many, many times. And then the threshold actually drops as conjecture by Maldeson and Susskind, because the winding number is N1, N5. It drops by to 1 over N1, N5, L. And that's very important if the threshold remained of the order of 1 by L, because compact circles are usually of order Planck size. You could never model a black hole, which is very big and can obviously swallow very long wavelengths. But with this effective string, it can swallow very long wavelengths. In fact, even the scale matches the energy of the last thermally emitted quanta, and they use that. If you do the four-charged black hole, which was a natural extension of the three-charged black hole, which initially came up in the work of Stromae and Maldacena, then of course you get this triple fraction, you get three charges down there. And there should be an L there. Okay, so this is just the usual idea of how momentum modes running on a circle get fractionated. But this fractionation actually has a rather important consequence, which is what I'm trying to chase down. I just first put down the consequence here and then take you through a set of calculations as to how one comes. But this is what ends up happening. If you take a three-charged black hole with N1, N5, and NP charges, and you bring a test quantum at some distance from the charge, and you ask at to what distance should I bring this so that actually macroscopic objects can stretch out and wrap around this. Macroscopic brains can stretch out there and wrap around this. You try to estimate a size at which you can actually feel this object. You find a size which has some complicated expression, but in fact all the parameters here are exactly the right place for it to be the horizon size of the three-charged black hole. It actually becomes rather big. And so this is the physics here. You get a very light fractional excitation because of fractionation. They extend far out from r equal to 0. And in fact, if you put all the numbers properly, it goes up to the horizon scale. I want to show you a little bit of how this actually works out. I just put on the bottom line first to tell you why I'm taking a slight detour and talking about things a little differently from the... Do I still have about 6-7 minutes? I should start 5 after. So I want to recall a little bit of the story of the correspondence principle of Horowitz and Polchinski, which came up around 96. So if you take a string at coupling g less than some value, then you can count the states of the string. At larger values, you might think it would turn into a black hole. And at least in some cases, and these are people have been trying to extend that to make it more uniform, the entropy sort of matches at the place where the string goes to a black hole. So you would say that we understand something. The string sort of smoothly goes into a black hole at some critical value of the coupling called GC. However, there was one small thing about this in those days which was slightly worrisome to me, and that was the fact that at the matching point, the gray body factors didn't quite agree. The radiations from here, the radiation from the black hole didn't quite agree, and this came up in the work of Emparan. Emparan wasn't too worried about it, but I want to show you why one should really worry about this and what it might teach us in the end. So in fact, here this was a very general principle. So in particular, you could apply it to a domain where we are more confident of what we know, which is a near extrema story. So let's take this case we've been working with so far. You take M9,1, you wrap it to 4,1, take the T4 and the S1, and take the elementary string and wrap it lots of times like we've been doing and put momentum on it. So take two charges, largest charges. And now if you want to put some extra vibrations on it, if you excite the string, you think it will go into momentum, anti-momentum modes, the further vibrations of the string. If you do this though, and you see how the string radiates out energy, this is how you're working at G less than GC, the left temperature is much higher than the right temperature. Left is because you already had some P in there, and the right one had no P. The temperatures are very unequal, but if you take the two-charge black hole, FP can be dualized exactly to D1, D5. Near extremal D1, D5 doesn't have the third charge. The left temperature actually is equal to the right temperature. The dualities are all in the compact direction. They don't affect transverse radiation. So in fact, the gray body factors matched if you kill the momentum charge. But if you turn on the momentum charge, they cease to match. And you wonder whether one should worry about it. In fact, there was something which was, I think, more significant. If you take the quanta which were actually emitted in the gray body factors, the spins were not quite correct. If you look at the black hole, it turns out that it only emits at low energy scalars. The emission of higher spin particles is suppressed by an angular momentum barrier. But here, actually, if you look at this guy, gravitons with both indices along T4, which are scalars in the non-compact space, they are emitted by the string. But equally well, if you have the gravitons has indices in the transverse directions, they're emitted equally because all the eight transverse directions are the same. Somehow the spin dependence is also not matching. And in the original papers on black hole, somehow one used to compare, one thing which one compared apart from gray body factors was the spin dependence. So I tried to look at this a little carefully then in 97. What the story I'm telling you now is from this old paper of 97. And based on the fluffy object size which I was quoting to you in the last transposition from this, that's why we actually started doing this whole systematic study of two charge and making all this here. So in some sense, I'm chronologically going backwards. But this is only an estimate. And I want to show you that. So let's talk for the story again we were just talking about. You have your T4 cross S1 compactification. You wrap your fundamental string there. It carries some momentum. And if you add some energy to it, and you might think you vibrate the string up and down, no more charge, just adding energy, it will go to PP bar pairs. The minimum threshold of excitation, as we know, is 4 pi over N1L. N1 is the number of times this is wrapped. That's the threshold of excitation. For any given amount of energy, you can compute how much entropy it will carry, blah, blah, blah. But there's something a little curious about this. If you look at D1, D5 momentum system, you know by dualities you can permute all these three charges among themselves. So in particular, you could make it D1P, D5. Or if you do an S duality, you could make it FP, NS5. And then the D1, D5 system, we know if we had no momentum charge, just had D1, D5, if you add a little bit of energy, it goes into creating PP bar pairs, whose energy goes as 4 pi over N1 and 5L. But if you just did that by duality, if you start with an F and P system, the energy should go into creating NS5, NS5 bar pairs. Whatever that might mean, but if you just compute the energy of that, just doing the duality map, the energy of the NS5, NS5 bar pairs, five brains are heavy, they have a G square in the bottom. But notice that you will still get a fractionation by the two charges which are present. So I'm just taking this and dualizing it there. So now you start wondering whether this is the right story, and you make 5-5 bar pairs if you excite an FP. Or if you excite an FP, you simply make PP bar pairs. At small g, of course, this is too expensive and you wouldn't do it. But then you notice that here there are this double fractionation, and here there's only single fractionation. So for large enough g, perhaps, this would win out. And if you try to ask at what g the two actually change over, you find at g less than the less than gc, less than the point of the correspondence principle, the energy actually goes to vibrating the string. And as you go for g greater than gc, the energy actually goes here. So in fact, it's the same point. And you should notice that all the other parameters canceled out. The volume of the torus, the length of the circle, the g, N1s, N5s, they all canceled. You just get left with the same gc. So somehow it seems that there's a little subtlety to the correspondence principle. The entropies might match at the correspondence point, but the entropies are measuring rather different degrees of freedom, the effective dynamical degrees of freedom actually change at G equals GC. If you add extra energy, it doesn't go to PP bar, it actually goes to 5 brains. And when you do that, the gray body factors fall in line. Because if it's the third guy which is actually doing the vibration, the gray body factors don't change in duality. So you can see the left and right temperatures become equal, there are different vibrations, the spins become correct, the gray body factors become correct. But the only thing I want to take away from this part of the story is that you get these phase transitions where you can create fractal brain-antibrain pairs, and though in some language one might not be able to be visualize what's a fractal brain-antibrain pair, just by dualities one knows that, so you have to get that.
Yeah. So you're saying that where you would have had a black hole, you instead have this FT and S hot?
Yeah, the moment you switch to the black hole category, G greater than GC.
Yeah.
If you try to...
You say that that's no longer relevant, that solution?
The metric of it? No, I didn't follow the question.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of a point you're making. We had transitioned a GC from D1, D5P to a black hole. You have a transition from D1, D5P to FP and S5, not to a black hole, is that right?
Okay, no, let me just make the point again. I'm not taking D1, D5P. Yeah, yeah. We are only going to look at FP. Look at FP and just ask the question, if I throw some energy onto an extremal FP, where does it go? Does it go into creating more PP bar pairs, or does the energy go actually into creating NS5 NS bar pairs? Okay. At low G, exactly like you said, if you see a string, it should behave like a string, it should make PP bar, and it does. In the other phase where you would have gotten a black hole, if you keep trying to push the microscopics and see what the microscopics tell you, at that point what the microscopics are doing is not that inside the black hole a string is trying to sit in a very densely interacting way and carrying the energy, extra energy into vibrations. What a string is doing in that denser phase where G has become more than GC is that the string is actually trying to create NS5, NS5 bar pairs. So the effective degrees of freedom into where the energy goes when you excite it change character just as you start crossing GC. Something else becomes lighter. Right. So
I guess another way of asking Joe's question, I mean, this estimate is ignoring gravitational back reaction. You're just doing basically string theory putting it in.
Yes.
You're not including the gravitational.
Yeah, but I think that is why actually I went to the limit of two large charges, because then this in the limit when two charges are large and the third charge is very small compared to it, this is the limit where we know that the entropies and gray body factors work perfectly with the black hole because of the near extremal entropy story. Okay, so here we know that the count which I do this way, the delta E and the entropy I compute from this delta E, I'm only going to stick to absolutely known results where the entropies and gray body factors match down to the last factor of 2 and pi. With the black hole. So we don't know why those microscopic estimates agree with the black hole. As Joe was asking before, those are two different couplings and we don't know why. And possibly there's a 1 by n effect which protects you. Okay, I'm not proving that. But using the same numbers, and that's why I've gone to large charges rather than deal with a string doing whatever. At least for these large charges, we see that the same point where you cross over from the string to the black hole is also a phase transition point where some other degrees of freedom becoming lighter. And so one shouldn't think that the strings just become. If one thought the string became more strongly interacting but was still trying to absorb the energy into vibrations, it's not quite that. The energy is actually going somewhere else. Okay. It doesn't contradict the correspondence principle. I mean, that's the same point where you're going to a black hole. It's just adding a extra twist to it. That's also the point where the phase transition is happening. So you want to notice the degrees of freedom and how they rearrange. And that's why the gray body factor didn't match. You notice that and then they do match. If the domains didn't quite overlap, they're not the same point, you could still have pulled out a contradiction about the gray bodies. So okay, you can try to play the game a little further, and you can play the same game this way. Now you take this N1, N5, NP3 chart system and give a little bit of non-extremality. And you know if you give a little bit of non-extremality, you make PP bar pairs, assuming P was the smallest charge. Again, the usual D1, D5P system that we are all familiar with. But this time what I'll do is, apart from the T4 and S1 which were compact, I'll make one more direction compact, S1 hat. And that I have drawn like this. So this is my three-charge black hole. It's non-extremal, so a little bit of R0 radius in it, but then I put it in a box, some size. And now you can see the number of compact directions are correct to make it the near-extremal four-dimensional black hole. In the four-dimensional black hole, we had compactified 6 circles. And also for the 4D black hole, as you recall, the near-extremal entropy, gray body factor, they all work down to the last. So I can use those entropy formulae. And so again, I'll ask the question, if I have some non-extremality, does the energy go into making PP bar pairs? But if I were to actually think of it as a four-dimensional black hole, in the 4D black hole, the charges were N1, N5, NP, and KK monopoles. So again, because you can completely permit them around, if you had these three charges large, any extra non-VPS entropy in the four-charge black hole would be carried by pairs of KK bar. Well, can KK bars really exist? If the circle is very big, the mass of a closed Klein monopole goes like the length of that circle, it's proportional to the length of that circle, so it's going to be very expensive. And so you think that they wouldn't exist. As you make the length of that circle smaller, at some point, it actually becomes advantageous to make these KK bar pairs. And you can ask, when does the transition happen for some size of circle that you're going to switch from having a three-charge black hole sitting like this to the energy being in PP bar to actually using triple fractionation and making KK bar pairs, just dualities in the old entropy argument being played over again. If you ask, when does the transition take place, when this length L prime, if it is bigger than R naught, you see this ball sitting in here and the circle is doing nothing. If L prime is less than R naught, you actually change over to the other kind, the degrees of freedom all switch into KK bar pairs. But that's also a scale where you might expect for the system the Gregory-Laflamme kind of instability to happen. If you crush a black hole to a size smaller than R0, it tries to become a black string. Is there any indication of that thing on the microscopics? Well, that's the point where the entropy is telling you, instead of putting the energy into PP bar pairs, it actually goes into these fractional KK monopole pairs, which wrap into these directions. This is all just duality, and the same old numbers on near extremal entropy, so there's absolutely nothing free here, and I guess you can't avoid this conclusion. But the only thing I want you to take away from this is that the size at which you start feeling this box R0 is not a size of order L Planck or L string. Depending on how big I make these charges, I could make the size as big as I wanted. So in fact, we have seen that fractional brain objects stretch over macroscopic distances and wrap over circles. So we can see from this that you can actually, just by using dualities, you can see fractional objects. And this real, the story is that here again, you have triple fractionation, you have double fractionation. These objects were heavier than this, but then the triple fractionation bends over, and you get these fractal objects. They are big, they go across a macroscopic scale, the Gregory-Laflamme point, it's a macroscopic scale. You can see the whole thing coming out from the phase transition. So this is, I'm just trying to build up the story of why the fractal objects come. Since I'm out of time, I'll just run this last part. Real, I'll just tell you what I did, but without showing you how it was done. So now if you just take the extremal three-charge system, you want to see what size does it have. How big is this extremal three-charge D1, D5, P bound state? So you bring a test quantum somewhere here. Okay, the object is kept here. The test quantum, you bring it here. You ask if you can actually have objects that stretch out and wrap around the sky. But where's the energy budget? This is extremal. You have no energy to create those pairs. We won't add any energy, but if you bring in quanta within a distance r of this guy, of course it has an energy at least 1 over r just from the uncertainty principle, and that's the only tiny energy budget we'll allow ourselves. With that energy budget, we'll ask the following. Suppose we actually, this object is being brought here, I'll just replace it by walls being kept at a distance r. With just this much energy, is it actually favorable for me to go and use to create accelerated objects to go all the way and wrap across this distance r? If I could, then of course you could argue that things can actually stretch up to the distance of this test quantum using only its localization energy 1 over r. And so what are you going to compare? You compare the entropy you get if you don't wrap it, and then you compare the energy which you get if you use this much energy, and then you do create the pair and you go and wrap it. Because it's again just a box, 3D black hole, one more box, 4D black hole. All the entropy counts are known, same near extremal entropies, all numbers known down to the last two. The last thing we require on top of all this is that if you create these extra brain-antibrain pairs, the entropy for creating them should be greater than the entropy for not creating them by at least one. We want these pairs not only to be possible, but to be probable. And if the entropy for creating those is at least one unit more, then the phase space for actually having that wrap configuration, the brain stretch out, is 2.7 times the phase space of not creating it. So then the guy is more likely to do it than to not do it. So you do that whole story and you ask, at what distance will that happen? Of course, if r is very small, they can stretch very easily, and the energy budget also 1 by r is a little bit higher. If this is r is very big, the brains will be very expensive and the energy budget is also lower. At which r does the whole thing turn over? And so what is the r where you can effectively come and feel these long fractional brains coming out and grabbing you? And again, all the things fall into the right place, and the r you get, a function of all the 7 parameters which come in the problem, it's just the order of the radius of the horizon. So everything just falls into place, and you get this classical size. So somehow, if you keep estimating the brain size using only numbers which you already know, near extremal entropies, and just using dualities on them, these fractal objects are floppy. They go quite far out, and then they keep grabbing you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip over the rest of my transparencies and save them for if you ask a question. I sort of made it in such a way that I don't have to put them up unless you ask me about it. So I'll skip the part of non-extremal systems unless somebody asks me for the question thing. And let me just put up my conclusion sheet here because I'm out of time. So this is the claim, the idea we've been pushing here. It's a nice picture of the black hole. And now we are wondering if the whole thing instead is a big fuzzball. I haven't actually shown you this. There's a transparency about it if somebody's interested later. If you actually look at the Hawking argument, and it actually can be converted to a Hawking theorem. We struggle a lot with this. If you actually have all non-localities which are less than equal to a given length, like Planck length or string length, but a fixed length, if all non-localities are on a bounded scale and the vacuum is unique, you can actually prove you will get information loss. That is, you can show that it's wrong to think that small, subtle quantum gravity effects will actually leak your information out in that situation. That was one of the things driving us to look for. So if you want to resolve the information paradox, you are looking for non-locality on a macroscopic land scale. I haven't shown you that, so let me not push the point. For D1, D5P, if you make a size estimate, the ones I was just showing you from fractionation, so this is earlier work done in 97, it shows you that the long floppy object created by fractionation, the same thing will give the entropy, the same fractionation also gives them big sizes. There's an abstract argument about here, which also I didn't show you, but if you want, I can show you later. Individual microstates should have no horizons, because if they had horizons, you'd have to attribute to them a further entropy themselves. But if individual microstates have to have no horizons, then there can't be simple perturbations on the naive picture like this. They must radically change the whole interior. It should be something like this. And I can run that argument through if you like, but also I haven't shown you. What I did show you was this. For D1, D5, for which I argued the horizon area, what we were calling the horizon area, where the states were, they were like fuzzballs, and the size sort of blew up to the size which gave the entropy. And also the fact you can't make a classical metric for this with horizon, I was trying to argue not so serious because these guys are big compared to both LP and LS or any other scale you might think of. And the fact that an even larger length scale in the problem is sort of irrelevant to the fact of what the states are doing. And then for several subfamilies of the D1, D5 momentum system, we have seen we get a similar picture of cap geometries, and it never passed through r equal to 0 into the interior. Of course, that meant along with it that the interior part had to change, which meant you wanted a change for the D1, D5P over macroscopic sizes. But that then exactly ties up with this. Once you know that you can change physics over the scale of the order of RH, it ties in with the fact you can actually also cap off these geometries out of the horizon because you change things over the scale of the horizon. And there have been recent works on the Benner cross and some things that Don was showing me, I think supertube, which also show that you get very large structures when you try to put various charges together from these fractal brains. Things just swell up to very large sizes, so perhaps soon we might get some more feedback on how the story works in general. Okay. Thank you.